Last week we started discussing inflation, and inflation is really an idea that before the radiation era, there was an era of rapid expansion of the universe, when the universe expanded like crazy, and so this is the most conveniently described in terms of the Hubble radius. Which is basically determined by two scales you have in your FRW spacetime, by the scale parameter A and by the Hubble expansion rate H. And so this thing here, and it basically tells you, how big regions are causally connected in nearby future or now. Okay, so it's slightly different to a horizon radius or whatever, where it basically tells you, the regions which could connect in the past, but this one tells you, well, these regions actually can talk to each other now. Okay, so that's R hat here. And so this thing here had to shrink exponentially. During the inflation period, and so you define the number of e-folds, which is this capital N thing here, and it's given by the initial radius divided by the final when the inflation finished. And so I mentioned three puzzles, and some of them are really puzzles. So one of them, for example, is only puzzle if you believe in gut theories. And that's the problem of monopoles. But anyway, so these three puzzles, they have basically the same origin, and you can explain them by really saying this initial radius was much, much bigger than the final one. And that much, much bigger means that you need and something of the order of 60, so that you can really actually solve these puzzles. And you will study that in your tutorial tomorrow, so you will see where this number 60 comes from. Okay, and so we also studied some kinematic conditions for the inflation to be successful, and so we introduced two parameters, epsilon and eta, and they have to be much smaller than one. So epsilon was defined to be minus h dot over h square, and that has to be much smaller than one. And another parameter, eta, which is given by epsilon dot divided by h epsilon, and that also has to be much smaller than one. And physically, the first one tells you, yes, I have to have rapidly shrinking Hubble radius, so rapidly shrinking R-hat. And the second one tells you, yeah, well, this has to actually last sufficiently long so that I can get this huge number of e-folds. So lasts long enough. If you had, huge changes in this parameter here, well, if you had huge changes in epsilon dot, wouldn't be true. Yes?
Just to clarify, epsilon is not between 0 and 1, is it?
Well, typically it is. You'll see in our example today, it's, so for example, for Desiter expansion, it's just 0. For the scalar field, which you'll discuss, is something like the ratio of kinetic energy divided by the ratio of total energy, and it again goes from 0 to 1.
And in the inflation case?
Sorry? That's the inflation case. both of them are inflation case. You will see explicit examples of this. Okay, so that's the kinematic conditions. And then we were asking what type of fluid in the universe, what type of matter actually can drive inflation? And we arrive at a strange equation of state. So matter driving inflation has following equation of state, which is rho plus 3t is smaller than zero. And that comes simply by considering the acceleration equation, Friedmann's acceleration equation, and you see that you can have accelerating universe only if this is true. So your w must be smaller than 1 over 3. And I told you that this might be seemingly a problem because it violates some natural conditions you impose on matter in general relativity. But OK, so this is a very strange solution for the universe. So we require some strange matter to be present at the time. And so finally, let me stress that really inflation is just an idea or a framework rather than one concrete theory. And so there is many concrete realizations of this idea, and they differ significantly. But really, you know, this is the main idea. And then, yeah. So there are various types of inflation. So for example, one example is this false vacuum decay or whatever, or vacuum inflation. That's one example. And so there you basically assume that at the inflation era, the universe was driven by basically a constant, cosmological constant, if you want, which was very, very large and positive. Okay, so the universe dominated by constant density. If you want, we have large lambda here. People don't really denote it by lambda, but OK. And so then you know that your universe really behaves like Desiter space. So we have basically exponential.
What is called false?
Sorry?
What is false?
OK, I'll tell you. Desiter expansion. Of course, the simplest realization of this that you are saying, well, this lambda is something like zero energy of your vacuum. And then the idea is that this is really, really huge lambda. But maybe there is some smaller minimum in your potential. So you are somewhere at a constant density. But then maybe you can fluctuate, quantum mechanically tunnel to something which is of lower lambda. So that actually, so maybe there was some huge lambda to start with, and then there are several steps, and you cascade like decay to the true vacuum, which is maybe now or maybe not. Okay, and so this was basically studied in Ruth's course. So she had this expanding bubble of nothing, and she had one vacuum inside and the other vacuum outside, basically, and it was a tunneling process coming from one vacuum to another. And you, in the end, you had like an expanding bubble where one vacuum was expanding to another vacuum. OK, so this is precisely that thing here. and so exponential Desiter expansion, you can easily check that these quantities here are both equal to 0. So 0 is much, much smaller than 1, so that's fine. OK, and then we have really the Desiter space, if you want. So ds is just, minus dt square plus 2. Because I wanted to make connection with Ruth's course, I even changed the signature in the notes. So OK, this is the right signature in this course. Dxi square, this is for k equal to 0. But it's just the Desiter space, as you know it from your tutorial expansion. So now, what are the problems with this? So problem. So if you are in vacuum, then classically you cannot, climb up the potential and go to a lower potential. So classically you stay in the vacuum. So there's no way you would leave that vacuum. So classically, expansion never ends because you are at the bottom of your potential. It's not necessarily the global minimum, but it's a local minimum, and then you cannot leave that classically. So quantum mechanically, yes. Quantum mechanically can end through tunneling. And I would encourage you, if you are interested in this, just open that lecture by Roos and read that lecture where the tunneling was studied. But the problem is that, yes, you can now actually finish this era of exponential expansion, and you can start a new era of a lower vacuum. But you have this expanding bubble of nothing, or expanding bubble of your vacuum. And actually, that will completely eliminate any structure formation. If you had any structures in your former vacuum, then these will be completely destroyed in some sense by the new vacuum. So we don't observe no universe as we know it. Of course, that may be a problem of the simplified model, but as the and that's why actually Roos studied. How does this get changed if you put some black holes in it and stuff like that? If you start putting some other things. So if you put some black holes in it, actually the rate of the tunneling gets increased. And so in some sense, if you put more black holes, I think if you put just one black hole, it's enough. And then the rate significantly jumps. And so it seems like we are really, really in trouble if our vacuum is unstable at this point. Because we know there is at least one black hole. And if there is at least one black hole, and we are not in the global minimum, but we are in some local minimum only, then the rate of tunneling from this guy to that guy would be huge. So I encourage you to read papers by Ruth Gregory on this topic. And she has a couple of papers. And really, the rate is enhanced a lot. So we are really in trouble if this is the case. OK, so that's one example of inflation. Another example, which is quite a favorite one, is the slow roll inflation, which we will basically discuss a little bit more in detail now. And so this is driven by a scalar field. Scalar field phi. That scalar field is called inflaton. Why not? And it's basically something like a mainstream scenario of inflation, if you want. And so that's why we'll discuss a little bit more in detail now. And then there are various variations of this scenario. So usually the problem is that we know that we have to have inflation for sufficiently long time, but then in the end, we have to exit that inflation era. So we have to actually start the radiation era. So in some sense, we have to change whatever is happening with your inflaton to the standard particle content of your standard model, and you have to have something like hot Big Bang. Okay, so this is quite problematic if you have just one scalar field, and so that's why people put sometimes many scalar fields, so hybrid inflation, so another scalar can end inflation. So you have basically one scalar field which is driving which is causing your universe to expand, and then you have another one which tells you, well, this was enough, and now we can start our radiation era. And so there's this extra scalar field which makes this thing something like a Higgs mechanism, in some sense.
People use scalar fields for simplicity, or is there a reason why we wouldn't use the tensorial field?
That's a good question. I would say for me, it was always the simplicity, because here people almost can do with the simplest scalar field you can imagine. It's just the standard potential m square phi square. And that was true until recently, actually, the data ruled that out. it was like a holy grail of inflation. So you could just do all this, you know, predictive power of inflation with just one single scalar field, which would just have mass and no complicated potential. So, but now it's actually disfavored. So people are now in trouble. So they have nothing to teach, right? Because everything else is much more complicated. And this one is actually ruled out. But anyway, I'll mention this the simplest one. But I would say it's the simplest. And then if you started putting some extra fields, well, I don't know what would happen. So somehow you have to predict also that that the scalar field is not observable at this time. Yeah. So of course, if the inflation was present in the early universe, it must be still present, right? But usually people deal with it like say, well, it's probably too massive to excite it. So we actually don't see any excitations of the scalar field. And although the scalar field is still here, you don't observe any particles, you know, associated with the scalar field. So then similarly, if you introduce other fields, it would explain, you know, why we don't see them now, what's happening with them now, and so on. So yeah, but I would say it's the simplest. So now, of course, this is not true if you study inflation in string theory, because string theory predicts lots of various fields and lots of, and so typically for inflation in string theory, you have like the number of fields is actually huge. So yeah. and finally, there's something which is called K inflation and you know, many other things here, but I would say see exploration course if you're interested. So that's something again like a scalar field, but a scalar field has wrong kinetic term in some sense, and yeah, so there are some interesting consequences and interesting. So, but anyway, so this will be discussed in detail in exploration course, and so buzzword here is the Born-Hinfeld inflation. So I don't know if you heard about Born-Hinfeld theory. So originally, it's a theory of electromagnetism, which goes back to the beginning of the 20th century, which supposedly has much better properties than the Maxwell electromagnetism. But and then, you know, that there's some kind of Lagrangian, and then people keep rediscovering the same Lagrangian many, many times after that. And so most recently, actually, people like that Lagrangian in string theory, and it somehow describes how the electromagnetism couples to strings in some sense. And so this is like Born-Hinfeld field, or Lagrangian. Okay, so this is a huge chapter, but I'm not going to discuss it. See exploration. So there are many other scenarios, and I keep telling you it's just a framework, and so basically what you want to do is propose some reasonably simple scenario which is not in contradiction with the experiment. Okay, questions here? No questions? Okay, so now let me do a single field. Slow roll inflation. Just to show you how simple the model is, and it has, you know, quite good predictive power. So all you have to do is basically say, well, this is your action that is in addition to your gravity before x square root of minus g. And so this is the gravitational part, 16 pi g Newton. And so now you'll put matter part, which is just the standard scalar field, minus 1/2, d mu phi, d mu phi, right, this is the curve metric, g mu nu, and then some potential v of phi. Okay, so this is your simplest Lagrangian you can think of, and there's some potential to the scalar field. And so the variation with respect to phi gives me equation of motion for my scalar field, which is something like Klein-Gordon equation, but now slightly generalized. So you have a box on phi minus v prime of phi equals to 0. So you studied, you know, very similar thing in your tutorial on Friday. So very, very simple things. So this is my Klein-Gordon equation. This is dV over d phi. Then you can also calculate what is the corresponding stress energy tensor by variation with respect to delta g mu nu. So of course, you are getting Einstein equations coupled to scalar field with the corresponding t mu nu. So t mu nu, which is minus 2, oh no, square root of minus g. Okay, whatever. I'll use the notation I have here. And nobody knows what that means, delta g mu nu. So of course, the problem, what I'm addressing here is that if you, so this is a matter Lagrangian. But in the way this is written here, you know that this guy is not a scalar. So this L is actually not a scalar, it's a scalar density. Okay, so we know that this guy is a scalar, this guy is a scalar. So the scalar density actually contains the square root of g in it. Okay, so you have to take L matter, where it's square root of g, and this part here. Okay, so now if you calculate that, you get something which you know very well, d mu phi, d nu phi. That's the nice part. And then you have part proportional to g mu nu. So minus 1 half g mu nu, and then d phi square, and then minus g mu nu, and then v. And so you get 3 terms because you have to differentiate 3 terms. So 1 term which contains g is just square root of g and v. And then you have square root of g and this term, that's the second term. But you have also metric hiding here. You have g mu nu, d mu, d nu, phi. So that's why you have 3 terms here. Okay, so that's t mu nu. And so if you look at that t mu nu, and that's something maybe people don't know very often, is that the t mu nu for scalar field can be written in the form of perfect fluid. Okay, so can rewrite this as perfect fluid. So that means you want to compare with your t mu nu of perfect fluid, t mu nu, which is rho plus p, and then u mu, u nu, and then plus p g mu nu, where u square is minus 1. So you just want to compare with this perfect fluid thing. And if you are looking at what's happening here and what's happening there, it's obvious that there's this t part proportional to g mu nu, which is something like pressure. So we can immediately read that the pressure is something like minus 1 half d phi square minus v. Okay, so from here, you see that p is minus 1 half d phi square minus v. And then you have the term d mu d nu phi, which looks like u mu u nu. So you see that u mu must be proportional to d mu phi. Okay, and in particular, so u mu, it's actually normalized that because you have to have u square equal to minus 1. So u mu is minus d mu phi square root of that minus e phi square. And then finally, I can take that coefficient to be rho plus p. And so rho comes out to be minus 1 half d phi square, and then plus b. Okay? So really, you know, no matter which scalar field you have, you can always recast the corresponding t mu nu in terms of the perfect fluid, and this is the identification you have to make. Okay? So now you may be asking, what is the corresponding equation of state of this thing? So w, which is p over rho, well, it's just a fraction of the two, so it's minus 1 half d phi square minus v, and then minus 1 half d phi square and plus v. Okay? And so now you can actually, it's obvious that you can take certain limits. So basically you can prescribe what that field is doing for you. So whether it has lots of kinetic energy or whether it has lots of potential energy or what's happening. So now it's up to you to actually design the corresponding potential and design the corresponding field so that the scalar field is doing what you want. Okay, and so the two interesting limits are, one of them is Higley field, if you want. Higley field. And so that has this d phi square much, much bigger than the potential. And so if this is true, if d phi square is much, much bigger than potential, of course you neglect the potential in here and in here, and you are getting that W is actually plus 1. It's plus 1. And so using the formula that rho, let's remind you that rho, we show that for these components by integrating the first Friedmann equation, we show that rho goes like a to minus 3, 1 plus W, long time ago. So if you take W to be plus 1, then you are getting a to minus 6. So rho goes like a to minus 6. This is precisely how the perturbations or how the inhomogeneities behave in the universe. So people actually model this, for example, a structure formation of galaxies. Okay. So this is one possibility. So I have to design my potential so that, you know, if this is true, then I can actually use the scalar field description for formation of galaxies or stuff like that. So the other limit, which is interesting more for us, is that we have smooth field. And of course, that's the other limit. So V is much, much bigger than d phi square. And if that is true, then I'm just neglecting the first terms here. And then I have minus V and plus V, so W is minus 1. And that, of course, means that rho is constant. And that means basically inflation, De Sitter expansion. Okay, so, and of course, you can do anything in between, but these are the two limiting cases, if you want, which are quite of physical interest. Okay, so so we discussed the scale equation here. We discussed the team you knew. So now you actually have to write down what the Einstein equations are. And again, you can integrate them, and you can write down something like Friedmann equations. However, is this rho and p. Okay? So now it's not a big surprise. Is that the field equations can be written. So you have basically the Friedmann equation, which is 3 m Planck square a square. And now this is just given by the density. But the density is written here. So it's 1 half d phi square plus v. Okay. Oh, okay. So now, I'm cheating on you here. So what you have to do is that now you want to describe your inflation period, but you still want to preserve the homogeneity in an isotropy. And for that reason, actually now, so this was true what we discussed here for any scalar field, but now we just restrict to scalar field, which is just a function of time. And then you preserve your homogeneity in an isotropy. Okay, so here I am just restricting to this thing. So now I have this density here. Yes, thank you. Well, there's a minus here. And then, so this is dt phi square. And then the other part of phi w spacetime, but because phi depends only on t, it's just the first term which survives. So it actually comes out to be plus phi dot square plus v. Okay, so that's one of the equations. And the second equation is, of course, the scalar field equation here, where you, however, have to write down what this box explicitly means in your FRW spacetime. And so that reads phi double dot plus VH phi dot plus E prime of phi equals to 0. So you have these two equations, if you want, which govern your inflation. Okay. So now this is just the mathematics coming from having a scalar field. So now in order to have inflation, we have to have those two constraints. We have to have that epsilon is much, much smaller than 1, and then eta is much, much smaller than 1. So these kinematic equations imply some restrictions. So now what these restrictions basically do is, as we shall see, is that they kill the first term here, and they kill the first term here. Okay, so this will be the approximations satisfying both these conditions in your inflation period. So how that goes? So first, notice that epsilon is just minus h dot over h square. So now by playing with these equations, you can show that this is equal to 1 half pi dot square over m Planck square h square. Okay. So now if you're looking at this thing here, so of course m Planck square h square is just the total density of the field. So it's the total energy density produced by my scalar field. And of course this guy here is just the kinetic energy density. So this is like epsilon kinetic divided or rho kinetic divided by rho total. And so you want this to be much, much smaller than 1. So basically what you are saying is that the kinetic energy of that scalar field must be really, really small when compared to the total energy. Okay. So that's one of your conditions. And of course what it means is that you can neglect this phi dot square with respect to the h square. Yeah. Okay, in other words, I can really neglect the first term. You seem very unhappy about that. Is that okay, or it's okay? Okay, so the other condition was that eta, which was epsilon dot over h epsilon. And then you can show, and I'm again not going to show that, that this can be written as 2 epsilon minus delta, where you define delta to be phi double dot, and then minus, and then h and phi dot. Okay, and so if you want to have eta much smaller than 1, you can show that this delta actually has to be much, much smaller than 1. Okay, so that's your second condition. In other words, your f double dot must be smaller than h f dot. And so that's precisely this condition here. Okay, so when really you impose these two kinematic equations and you can play with that, actually I think you will play with that in your tutorial. So then your equations really simplify to have something much, much easier. So you have just 3 h phi dot plus b prime equals to 0, that's equation 1, and then 3 m Planck square h square equals to v. That's an equation. So that's... Now we can also understand why this is really called slow roll inflation. So slow roll means that really the kinetic energy of the scalar field is much more than the total energy. So the scalar field is actually sort of slowly rolling down your potential. Okay, it's not rapidly oscillating around some minimum or whatever, but rather it's slowly changing, you know, kinetic energy here. So really the fact that rho kinetic much, much smaller than rho total means slow roll. Okay, so now we have to go through the pain here. So, okay, so these are our equations and these are our conditions in some sense. But of course, people who want to design this thing here, they are asking, you know, what type of potential I can use to describe my inflation, my scalar field. Okay, so really the design, you know, the aim is to design what this potential has to be so that this is consistent with observation. Okay, and so for that, you actually have to rewrite these conditions and these equations in terms of the potential. So, in terms of V, okay. And so the conditions here that delta is much, much smaller than one and that epsilon is much, much smaller than one can be written in terms of this potential V, and it's very simple. So now we introduce another epsilon, which is basically, which is called epsilon subscript V, which is like a condition. It's the same epsilon as before, but now it's written in terms of the potential. Okay, and this is written as M Planck square over 2 and V prime over V square. And of course, it's still the condition that epsilon is much, much smaller than 1. So this is your condition in terms of the potential. And then you can introduce another parameter, eta V, which is not the delta, but it's actually epsilon plus delta. But it's both of them are smaller than 1. So the sum is also smaller than 1. And this is M Planck square V double prime over V. And you require that this is much, much smaller than 1. Okay, so these are the conditions what your potential has to satisfy so that you have your inflation. So let me just show you the first one because it's simpler. Well, both of them are very simple, just one line calculation. But let me just rewrite how really using these things here you are getting the first condition. And so you are getting, so you can do, you can square the first equation. So if I denote this equation as 1 and this equation as 2. So squaring the first one and dividing by the second one square. Okay, so squaring the first one, you're getting 8 square pi dot square is equal to something like v prime square divided by 9. And then 2 square is M Planck to the 4. And Planck to the 4, H4. Well, okay. So, of course, not the first equation squared. Okay, so this is V prime square divided by V square. But if you look at your definition of what small epsilon is, and so you find that it's 1 half phi dot square over M Planck square 8 square. Then you see that this is just nothing else than 2 epsilon divided by M Planck square. Okay, so if you look at the definition of epsilon and just look at here. So now just expressing what epsilon is from here, you arrive at the first relation there. And similarly, you can do the second equation. So really, the aim of this exercise is to say, you know, what are the conditions on my potential so that I can get inflation right? So now, these are the kinetic equations. So the potential has to satisfy this thing here. And then you may be asking it how many e-folds I'm getting from a given potential. So let's say I am constructing the theory of inflation. So really, I'm designing this potential V, and I satisfy these two conditions. So then another question to check is, you know, can I actually get the right amount of inflation I need? Can I get N equals 60 or something like that? OK, so that's another thing to check. And so this N, the number of e-folds, From the definition over there, it's just logarithm of R initial divided by R final, which is, if you plug for the Hubble radius, it's just A final, H final, A initial, H initial. So now what happens throughout the inflation is that actually H doesn't change much. So for example, if you have De Sitter expansion, H is just a constant. Okay, and then what you can show is that if you know both these kinetic equations are satisfied, that H actually has to be approximately constant, something like that. So I can approximate this as just logarithm A final or A initial, just to get an estimate if you want. Of course, this is not exactly true, but almost true. Okay, so now I just write it as trivial identity, an integral from A initial to A final d of logarithm of A. That's a trivial identity. And then, again, trivial identity by using what A is that T initial, T final, H, dt. So H is A dot over A. So it's just equal to that. Okay. And then this thing, you can write dt as a d phi over dt and d phi. So you can also change it to phi initial, to phi final, h d phi, and then phi dot. Again, trivial identity. Okay. A stream of completely not making any sense identities. But anyway, so we are getting somewhere. So now if you look at this thing, that h over phi dot actually appears in one of your approximate equations. So h over phi dot is something like v prime divided by something. So which one I'm using? H divided by phi dot. You probably have to take the first one. So the first equation here, if you use the first equation, what you should be getting is that this is minus 3 phi initial phi final h square over v prime d phi. Well, that's coming from that first equation here. And if you use the second equation, to express h square in terms of v, you are really getting 1 over m Planck square, phi initial, phi final, and then v over v prime, v phi. Okay? So this is, if you know the potential, how the potential looks like in terms of phi, you are getting that number of e folds out of it. And so, as I say, you can start, you know, playing with these things, and you can design various potentials. And so, for example, v of phi and phi. And so the typical picture which people draw, which does the job, is that the potential is, you know, slowly changing until it has some minimum here. And so you can imagine like a ball rolling down the potential. So when the ball is rolling slowly, then the phi dot square, the kinetic energy of the scalar field, is small. And so the inflation period is up to here. So this is my inflation. And then when the kinetic energy starts to be huge, then, you know, you don't satisfy those conditions anymore. So this is the end of inflation. And then at the bottom, of course, you would have the scalar field oscillating near the bottom. And that wouldn't do the inflation, but it's precisely when you would expect the reheating to happen. Reheating. So basically what you have to do here, and you have to devise a mechanism how to change these oscillations of the scalar field at the bottom of your potential to, you know, transfer them to energy of the standard particles in your model. Okay? So that's a typical potential which people draw when they say, well, inflation described by a single scalar field. So now, interestingly, even the potential like m square phi square really did the job until very recently. So e.g., b is equal to 1/2 m square phi square. It's a very, very nice model, the simplest you can imagine. But it's now ruled out by experiment, or it is favored if you want.
How recently?
Last year. Or maybe 2 years now, but yeah, very, very recently. So now actually people are designing potentials which are really, really crazy, like 5 to 3/2 or something like that.
Was it ruled out by Planck or like
that? Yeah. Well, it's a combination of results, which you know, and then you can plot these nice graphs. I don't know how they are really plotted, but you can plot these nice graphs and you can see, you know, what is the likelihood that it will be that potential, what is the likelihood it will be that potential, and so on. But I think the simplest one, which actually would really be nice from a theoretical point of view, right? So from a theoretical point of view, this would be the nicest possibility you could have, but it seems that it's probably ruled out. But anyway, let me still call Holy Grail of inflation. Which probably is not true. So if you take this potential here, then you can apply all these formulas which I derived here. And so you can, for example, calculate what is this epsilon v, and you find it's equal to eta v, and it's just 2 m Planck square divided by phi square. So now you require, in both cases, that this is more than 1. So it just gives you that phi is much, much bigger than m Planck. Okay, so we are saying that you have, super Planckian fields, something. So it's large. This is also called large field inflation. So really, the value of the scalar field has to be bigger than m Planck. So now you may be asking, is this a problem or not really if I have super Planckian field? But it doesn't have to be. In some sense, what you really have to have is that the corresponding energy density is much, much smaller than the Planckian energy density. Because if it's not, then you cannot believe the physics. But if it's just the value of the scalar field, well, who cares about the value, right? So large field inflation, but what you really require is that the energy density which is something like m square phi square, is much, much smaller than m Planck to the 4, which is the Planck density. And so by this requirement, you are getting that m is much, much smaller than m Planck. So the mass of the scalar field must be much, much smaller than m Planck. Okay. So now if you take that number of e folds and you use this beautiful formula how you calculate it in terms of the potential, actually you just plug there m square phi square and you find that this is given by, so n is something like 1 over 4 pi m Planck square phi initial square minus phi final square. Okay. So now you want this to be equal to, let's say, 60. So this is your requirement so that the inflation works well. Okay. So now we, however, have still the requirement that phi must be bigger than m Planck. Okay, so for that, I can do, let's say, well, phi must be much, much bigger than M Planck. So if it's 10 times bigger, I'm happy. So let's make it 10 M Planck. Okay, so 10 M Planck. Okay, and then the statement is, well, we still have to have that phi square is much, much smaller than M Planck 4 divided by M square. So much, much smaller. Again, I take the factor 10. Okay, so this will be satisfied if final is something like 1 over 10 M Planck square divided by M. That's the second equation. That's the condition that energy density is much, much smaller than Planck density. Okay, and then N is 60, so that I'm happy. So this guy is 60. And so what you are getting is that actually this is all fine. So what you are getting from here is that M Planck over M is something like 50. Okay, that's the condition which you are getting. In other words, you are actually finding everything is consistent and nice. So you don't violate any requirements of, you know, inflation. You don't violate any requirements of super Planckian energy densities. You have the right number of e-folds, just provided that the mass of the scalar field is actually something like 10 times smaller than the Planck mass. Okay, and then everything is fine. Okay, so that's the beauty of this theory. So we can, you know, you can do with the simplest potential, and it seems that everything is actually fits in, and this is really, and of course, you know, yeah, I think it's beautiful.
So,
yes.
So when you think about inflation, it's like at first we only had our scalar field, and when inflation ended, we kind of request that this field decays in all the particles.
Yeah, it heats up our standard model particles. Yes,
but it would also heat up, for example, the Higgs. But why does this field have mass?
I don't. Of course, you know. So the simplest models, people were thinking, okay, so now we have Higgs, right? Is it possible that Higgs is actually driving our inflation in the past, or, you know, and stuff like that? So for that, of course, you have to, you know, prescribe the potential and stuff like that. But I don't think it can be Higgs. It's not favored.
No, but I mean this. So Higgs is also present in all these pictures, right?
Yeah.
So it wasn't like heated up by the inflation. It was already there.
Well, the Higgs was probably heated up as well, right? Why wouldn't it be? If it's a separate field.
Yeah.
Does that be heated up? Okay, I don't know.
No, I was wondering because then where does this field get mass?
Okay, that's a good question, right? So, but, you know, so this is just a requirement. I'm saying if I have something like that, then, you know, everything is fine and everything works, right? But yeah, you may be asking why exactly this mass, where does it come from, and so on. Yeah, maybe asking. Okay, so that's the idea of inflation. By the way, there is still. So that there are two big problems with inflation. One of them is how to end it and how to heat up these things. That's the problem of reheating. Another problem is how you actually start it, right? And so there may be actually problems for initial conditions. So problem of initial conditions. For inflation, and in some sense, this is really, really crucial problem because, as we shall see in a couple of lectures, actually, you know, the inflation is, you know, was designed to really solve these three problems, like the hierarchy, the monopole problem, the horizon problem, and the third problem, the flatness problem. But actually, what you are really getting out of inflation is it seems that you are getting the right fluctuations, which actually now, you know, transfer to CMB and then transfer to structure formation and so on. So really, that's probably the most, the nicest thing about inflation is that it gives you the right fluctuations coming out of that. So now what people believe is that these fluctuations actually, you know, come out from quantum mechanical fluctuations. So you started your inflation, everything was quantum mechanical, and you had some quantum mechanical fluctuations. So now your universe starts expanding like crazy. So now what people believe, but nobody explained to me how this is really done, is that these quantum mechanical fluctuations are believed to become classical ones. So they are sort of like stretch. As the universe is expanding, the idea is that these quantum mechanical fluctuations stretch to huge classical fluctuations. Okay? And these fluctuations sort of freeze and they reemerge when the CMB is released in some sense. And then, so you can see them, these fluctuations, like the oscillations of the CMB, like the oscillations of the plasma before the CMB is released. And then, of course, this is transferred through, you can observe that in CMB, and these fluctuations should give rise to the structure formation in the universe. And you are, and so really the biggest asset of inflation seems to be that you are getting the right fluctuations out of that. Okay, that's much, much better than any other theory. So for other theories, actually, you are getting wrong fluctuations or stuff like that. So for example, if you had cosmic strings, the fluctuations would be completely different. They wouldn't correspond to what you see. So you know, biggest asset of this is really the fluctuation. But now the question is, this is all very nice, but you have to postulate what these quantum mechanical fluctuations look like at the very beginning. Or in other words, you know, what were the initial conditions for inflation and what was happening at the beginning of inflation? And so what you, in principle, just have done is that you postponed the right initial conditions for your plasma oscillations to the right initial conditions for your inflation. Okay, so now this is, of course, a problem. You're just shifting the problem to early universe, right? But the problem still persists. What are the right initial conditions and how they actually are done? So anyway, I refer you to this beautiful review by Brandenberger. And it's 16, archive 1601918. And that's a review of, you know, what you have to really do to have the right initial conditions for the inflation. And, you know, how likely the inflation itself actually is. So do I really, is it something which is like an attractor mechanism? So do I always start inflation? Or is it something which happens extremely rarely? Or what happens with the initial fluctuations during the inflation and stuff like that? So you can read this beautiful review. And so tomorrow we'll start fluctuation. Are there any questions? So this is a beautiful paper. And of course, famous cosmology. No questions? Okay, so we'll see you.